the studios of KPFK Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is Uprising and I'm Sonali Kohatkar. It's Wednesday, March 18th, 2015. 4 years after the Syria war, civilian deaths are being eclipsed by the U.S. war on ISIS. We'll speak with journalist Reese Ehrlich. And understanding the latest Republican stalling, this time on Loretta Lynch's nomination over an anti-trafficking bill. Plus the latest in our series on the politics of parenting, Frida Bergen joins us to discuss her book, It Runs in the Family, on being raised by radicals and growing into rebellious motherhood. That's coming up after the news. Joining us now to analyze today's headlines is Courtney Morris, Assistant Professor of African American and Women's Studies at Penn State University. Hi, Courtney. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has won a stunning victory in elections held yesterday. His Likud party trumped projections by pollsters and won more seats than any other party, including the newly formed rival Zionist Union Party. In the days before the election, Mr. Netanyahu tacked openly to the hard right wing of Israeli politics, including declaring there would be no Palestinian state if he won a second term and appealing to Jewish voters to counter the enthusiastic Arab Israeli vote. It appears as though his tactics paid off, but victory may have come at a steep price for Netanyahu, who now has to contend with few allies left both inside and outside Israel. Arab Israelis, who are 20% of the population, also turned out in record numbers and voted a united coalition of Arab parties into the Knesset with 13 seats, the third largest bloc this election and the largest ever won by Arab parties in Israel. The joint list, as it's called, is headed by 40-year-old Ayman Odeh and campaigned on an anti-racist platform. Courtney, are you surprised by these results?
Well, I would say yes and no. I mean, I think obviously yes, in the sense that many of the polls leading up to the elections predicted that Netanyahu was going to have a much tighter race than in fact it turned out to be. But no, I'm not surprised in the sense that I think that in some ways his victory really seems to be in keeping with the rightward shift that we've been seeing in mainstream Israeli politics. I mean, I think here in the West, we might have been surprised to hear Netanyahu say that he would never support the creation of a Palestinian state. But in practice, this is essentially what he's been doing for years. Right, blocking the negotiations process, continuing Israeli settlements in the occupied territories, and also continuing his military assault on Gaza. So, in the sense, it's not surprising. I think that he was really able to play on the fears of the Israeli public about terrorism and the place of Arab citizens in the Israeli body politic, and that really worked out in his favor. But you know, as you said, I think he's really going to have a challenge on his hand getting himself out of the mess that he's created for himself, not only in Israel but also in terms of repairing his deeply fractured relationship with the Obama White House.
Right. And in a story that's still developing as this program goes to air, Tunisia's National Bardo Museum is the site of a major hostage-taking and shooting incident this morning. Two or three armed men apparently took several people hostage and killed at least eight people in the Tunis Art Museum, seven of them foreigners. It was being reported that 10 hostages were being held, and as of now, dozens of people have been injured. Police have apparently shot two of the attackers, as per the Guardian newspaper, and a total of at least 11 people are dead. As of now, it is not clear who the attackers or what their motivations were. The museum is close to Tunisia's parliament, where lawmakers were debating an anti-terrorism law today. Some are speculating that the parliament may have been the original intended target. Meanwhile, here in the U.S., early this morning, a drive-by shooting in Stockton, California, left three people dead and four injured near a convenience store. The circumstances of that attack are still unknown, but authorities are calling it one of the worst mass shootings in the city's recent history. Courtney, it's too early to tell what has happened at either of these shootings, but the common thread seems to be access to firearms. What do you think?
Well, I think there's definitely some truth to that, although, you know, these are very different cases. I mean, obviously in Tunisia, you know, Tunisia has been dealing with the challenge of you know, these sorts of attacks since the successful regime change that took place there following the Arab Spring. And certainly there are indications that this may be a related kind of attack, especially in light of the discussion of the anti-terror bill, but also in light of the killing of a Libyan man, Ahmed Rouissi, who was suspected to have been involved in several terror attacks in Tunisia. So there's a possibility that those may be linked, but we're not sure yet. But in Stockton, you know, the case is a lot less clear. I mean, I think that we have so many of these kinds of random killings in the U.S. It suggests that perhaps we really need to rethink our relationship to guns and to the Second Amendment, because weapons are just way too accessible in this country, and the results of it are awful.
And by the way, the Tunisian prime minister is now announcing that 19 people are dead in Tunisia. Finally, in Europe, a mass action in Frankfurt against the European Central Bank, or ECB, has put police and authorities on edge. At least 10,000 people marched under the title of Blockupy, a name derived from the Occupy Wall Street movement, to denounce anti-austerity policies pushed by the ECB in countries like Greece. The ECB was set to inaugurate a new building that reportedly cost an unimaginable $1.4 billion. The ECB president, Mario Draghi, was scheduled to speak at the opening. Police in Frankfurt say that protesters threw stones and damaged police cars, even setting some of them on fire. The criticisms by protesters echoed what Greece's new finance minister, Yanis Varoufakis, has been saying, that these banks have stood in the way of solving Europe's financial crisis. Well, Courtney, Greeks are starving, and the ECB built a new building for $1.4 billion. Are you heartened to hear that people are protesting?
I absolutely am heartened to hear that people are protesting. I mean, austerity measures simply do not work. And in Greece, the consequences of this have been disastrous. There have been massive cuts to public sector employment, increased homelessness, increased rates of suicide, a number of people who have lost access to public health care. It's just not working. And I think that people are finding that even though transnational financial institutions like the IMF and the ECB are willing to bail out banks and governments, but they're not willing to bail out people. They're making decisions, policy decisions, that affect the lives of regular citizens, and citizens have no oversight in that process, and these institutions have no accountability to the people who are most impacted by these kinds of measures. So I think it is a heartening sign to see this sort of movement growing, and hopefully we'll see it spread to other places as well.
Courtney, always a pleasure to have you on. Thanks so much. We'll talk to you next week.
Bye, Sonali.
Courtney Morris is an assistant professor of African American and Women's Studies at Penn State University. This is Uprising. We'll be right back. This is Uprising. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. Did you know that Uprising is now a TV show as well as a radio show? We rely on subscribers to our YouTube channel to fund the TV production of Uprising, and you can sign up right now to be a subscriber at youtube.com/uprisingwithsonali. It's been just over 4 years since the horror that is the Syria war began. No, I'm not talking about the Islamic State and its conquest of northern Iraq and Syria, which seems to have eclipsed the wider war inside Syria. The war that has resulted in hundreds of thousands of deaths has faded into the background of the new ISIS war that the U.S. is eager to fight. After years of inaction, on Sunday, Secretary of State John Kerry admitted in a CBS interview that the U.S. needs to consider negotiating with the regime of Bashar al-Assad, despite the widespread documentation of his government's responsibility for mass killings. Here is what Kerry said.
There is no military solution. There is only a political solution. But to get the Assad regime to negotiate, we're going to have to make it clear to him that there is a determination by everybody to seek that political outcome and change his calculation about negotiating.
And you'd be willing to negotiate with him?
Well, we have to negotiate.
Well, we have to negotiate, is what John Kerry said. Earlier, CIA Chief John Brennan spoke at an event and warned that if the Assad regime were to fall, it would open up a power vacuum into which the Islamic State could step. Meanwhile, activists have just accused the Assad government of poisoning civilians, including children, with chlorine gas. Is the U.S. preparing to ally itself with Assad in the fight against ISIS? And if so, what about the hundreds of thousands of Syrian dead? Joining us to help answer those questions is Rhys Ehrlich. He's a veteran freelance foreign correspondent. He's traveled widely across the Middle East and has written a number of books, including Conversations with Terrorists, Middle East Leaders on Politics, Violence and Empire. His latest book is called Inside Syria, The Backstory of the Civil War and What the World Can Expect. He's been a frequent guest on Uprising. Welcome back to the show, Rhys.
Thank you so much for having me.
What do you make of Kerry and Brennan's comments? Could the U.S. be readying itself to ally with Assad?
Sorry, my
Yeah,
headset
let me
popped.
repeat
That's,
myself.
yeah,
What do you
it's.
make of John Kerry and John Brennan's comments? Is it possible that the U.S. might be laying the groundwork to essentially turn Bashar al-Assad into an ally?
I think that's been the plan since August of last year, when the U.S. did a 180-degree turn and made the Islamic State the main enemy. The result was that Assad and Iran actually became tacit allies. And now I think they're taking the next step, which is to try to make it an actual formal arrangement. I don't think it's going to get very far because I don't think Assad trusts the United States.
Well, speaking of not trusting the U.S., just this morning, apparently, a U.S. drone was shot down over Syria by the Syrian government that claimed that it was a hostile drone and vehicle that was flying overhead that the U.S. was in charge of. And so those are the sorts of things that we do see. As you said, it seems as though the Assad government may be the one pushing the U.S. a little bit away.
Well, I think for good reason, the Assad government doesn't trust the U.S. The U.S. is bombing inside Syria without any regard to the international law or any permission from anybody inside Syria. And of course, the U.S. could shift the bombing to attack Syrian government targets at any point. Now, none of this is to diminish the horrible war crimes that the Assad government is carrying out inside Syria. But the U.S. is clearly violating international law in its bombing campaign and is not going to make it, for, let's put it this way, a very trustworthy ally of Syria.
How realistic is the scenario that Brennan raised, that if Assad were to fall tomorrow, the Islamic State would be likely to step into that power vacuum and take control of the whole country?
Well, I don't think that's likely, but I think without Assad in power at this very moment, the country could well descend into chaos. That is, there are other rebel groups in addition to al-Nusra and the Islamic State that might well take power. You could have a situation as it exists in Libya, where there's no real central government, where local warlords and local militias control the situation, and it could be quite chaotic.
And al-Nusra is the al-Qaeda affiliate inside Syria. What do you make of these new allegations that just came to light earlier this week, just a day or two after the fourth anniversary of the war, that that the Assad government has used chlorine gas on civilians? In this case, at least six people, several of them children, reportedly killed by chlorine gas. Is this consistent with the earlier documentation of the use of chemical weapons?
Well, it's complicated because the rebels have accused the Assad regime of using chlorine gas on a number of occasions. And the most recently, the Kurdish officials in northern Iraq have said the Islamic State has used chlorine. Chlorine is relatively easy to make into a gas. You just need the chemical chlorine, which is easily available for industrial uses. And in these kind of charges and countercharges, I always wait to see if there's additional documentation. Mm-hmm. But whether or not the Assad government actually used chlorine gas in this particular case, it's been engaged in horrific war crimes. For example, dropping barrel bombs, which are 50-gallon oil drums filled with explosives and shrapnel, and just simply dropping them on civilian areas. It's engaged in hunger sieges of areas, sealing off entire parts of Damascus and other parts of the country and not allowing food or supplies to come in. So whether or not it's using chemical weapons, it's engaged in war crimes.
What do you make, Reese, of the reporting on what's happening in Syria? There was a time when the atrocities in Syria were center stage in our news, as they should be, given the scope of the just horrific human disaster unfolding there. But in recent months, anytime Syria enters the news, it's usually with regard to the Islamic State.
Well, just in case any of your listeners had the illusion that we have an independent press in the United States, this ought to abuse them of that. The Washington media, the mainstream media, follows the lead of the White House and, or the administration in power. And in this case, the U.S. did its 180-degree turn that said the Islamic State is more dangerous, so therefore the media focus on that. and the atrocities of the Assad government are downplayed. I think it's a shining example of the lack of independence by the major media.
And yet, before the Islamic State appeared on the scene, many progressives were wary of the news coming out of Syria and making much of the news because the worry was that the U.S. would intervene in Syria militarily, like it has done in Libya, and like, of course, it has done in Iraq and Afghanistan and continues to do so. And that fear, is also that is a real fear, yet it doesn't make much difference to those living inside Syria who are living a very precarious existence if they've even, are able to survive.
Well, it is ironic that those people who advocated humanitarian intervention by the United States got their wish, and the situation is even worse. That is, the current U.S. military intervention is not doing anything to bring down Assad. It's not doing anything to help the people of Syria. The U.S. has its own geopolitical, economic, military interests in the region that have nothing in common with what the ordinary people of Syria want. And I would simply note that just because the U.S. opposes or supports a particular group doesn't make them good or bad. You have to make your own independent evaluation. And the crimes of Assad indication of what he's doing, and now the U.S. is bombing, killing civilians, and has no way to win the war. There's no allies on the ground in Syria outside of a small number of Kurds.
And actually, that's a really good point to turn to next. What is the current status of the U.S.'s backing of rebel groups on the ground in Syria? There were reports that the U.S. had initially, or a few months ago, cobbled together a new group. There was another U.S.-backed group that disbanded. Who is the latest U.S. proxy inside Syria?
Yeah, it's like we have the new contender for the crown, and every time they get into a fight, they lose. The U.S. since 2011 has been trying to find some kind of a proxy force and has been unable to do so. By the way, not due to vacillation by Obama, but because the Syrian people don't agree with U.S. policy in the region. That's at the core of the problem. Mm. The last October, remember the Free Syrian Army? Those were the moderate forces. Well,
right.
The U.S. cut off all aid and political support to the Free Syrian Army as of October last year because they wouldn't go along with the new program of making the Islamic State the main enemy, and also because they didn't have that much support on the ground. The U.S. has claimed that it's finding moderate rebels to be trained in Saudi Arabia, Turkey, and Jordan, but that's what it's been claiming to do for the last 3-4 years. So right now, the U.S. has no allies on the ground with any significant military force, except for the PYD in the Kurdish regions in the far north of Syria, the people who fought in Kobani and so on, and they're affiliated with the PKK, a group that the U.S. considers to be a terrorist organization. So the U.S. has no allies except for a group that it considers to be terrorists, which, by the way, isn't, but that's another question.
Right. Now, the U.S., there have been reports that the U.S. is essentially going to be training Syrian rebels inside Syria, which is just very strange because if that is happening, the U.S. must have some kind of permission to operate, either tacit or overt, to operate inside Syria in whatever capacity to actually train these troops, not just provide weapons, but train them. And it seems as though there is just this unspoken understanding that the U.S. and Assad are simply on the same side now, in the same way that the U.S. has, seen fit to ally with the Egyptian military regime, for example?
Well, not necessarily, because if, in fact, the U.S. is going to be training rebels inside Syria, and that's still a big if, they could do it in rebel-controlled areas, either in the north close to the Turkish border or in the south along the Jordanian border.
I see.
But I would take that one as a definite, a giant maybe, because the U.S. is not going to introduce significant numbers of CIA or special ops forces into Syria where they might be killed and escalate the war to a whole new level.
Now, has the balance of power inside Syria changed significantly over the 4 years of the Syria war? When the war first began, it seemed more clear-cut that Syrians rose up against the Bashar al-Assad regime in concert with other Arab Spring movements around the region, Tunisia, Egypt, Libya, etc. And then, of course, things got complicated. The civilian support for rebel groups waned. The rebel groups themselves fractured, split. New groups rose. Some groups, went away. Groups changed tactics about how to approach the Assad regime. The Assad regime dug its heels in and seemed to get stronger. Support has flowed in from Russia. And over the last 4 years, the entire war has just gotten murkier and more complex. Is there a sense that Assad is essentially going to wait this out and just simply win through sheer force of persistence?
Well, I think you're absolutely right. On my visits to Syria and meeting with various rebel groups or opposition leaders, they expected Assad to be out of power in a matter of months, and he's hung in there far longer. For the last, certainly a couple of years, the situation is not good for either side. Assad only controls perhaps 40% of the country, including Damascus, or at least the center part of Damascus, but not even all of Aleppo, which is the largest city by population in Syria. The rebels, on the other hand, control perhaps 60%, but they're fragmented among various factions, including extremist groups and, shall we say, less extremist groups. But they don't get along with each other. They're not able to govern in a coherent way. So it's a military stalemate at the moment. And that's one of the reasons you haven't seen much progress for the UN or other efforts to have a political settlement, because both sides think that they can still win.
Well, finally, Reese, what needs to happen from the humanitarian perspective inside Syria? I mean, I cannot even imagine what might be going through the minds of ordinary Syrians sensing that the world has abandoned them, that there's just this political stalemate, that the powers that be have relegated them to a slow death or a quick death. Those are the only choices they seem to have. It's just, it's horrifying to think of what's happening to children who are bearing the brunt of the violence, ordinary people, women and men. It's a tragedy.
It is. It's a humanitarian tragedy of enormous proportions. It's largely been forgotten, particularly since the U.S. bombing. But there are some ways that could be solved. First of all, the United States has to stop its bombing, which is not helping. In fact, it's helping the Islamic State gain international notoriety and helping them recruit and ultimately damaging the efforts to establish a new government in Syria. The Syrian government of Assad has to stop its sieges of cities where it's blockading, for example, Yarmouk, the Palestinian area of Damascus, has been undergoing horrific siege by Assad and his allies. Food and supplies have to be allowed in by the UN or other international agencies. And don't forget about the Syrians living outside the country who
Are
living as refugees in northern Iraq and Turkey and Jordan and Lebanon, facing very, very difficult situations. The U.S., ironically, has been shortchanging its commitments to various humanitarian agencies while spending unlimited amounts of money on bombing. The U.S. has fallen behind in its donations to the UNICEF and other UN agencies. So all of those things are doable in an immediate run and would help the civilian population of Syria.
Well, Reese, I want to thank you, as always, for joining us today and helping to keep the focus on this tragedy. I want to thank you. And also, we will post your work on our website, which people can find at reeseerlich.com. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
My guest, Reese Erlich, is a veteran freelance foreign correspondent. He's traveled widely across the Middle East and has written a number of books, his latest being Inside Syria, The Backstory of the Civil War and What the World Can Expect. This is Uprising. We'll be right back.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Uprising. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. Just when the confirmation process for Loretta Lynch as Attorney General seems to be wrapping, a new obstacle has emerged this week in the GOP-dominated Congress. And as expected, it is a bizarre obstacle. An anti-human trafficking bill pushed by the GOP was held up this week by Senate Democrats over language concerning abortion. So Republicans hit back, saying they would hold Lynch's nomination hostage until the bill passed. Joining us to try to make sense of what's happening in the Capitol today is David Dayan, contributing writer to Salon and a weekly columnist at the Fiscal Times. Welcome to Uprising, David.
Thanks for having me.
Well, what does abortion have to do with the anti-trafficking bill? What does the anti-trafficking bill have to do with Loretta Lynch?
I don't think any of these things have anything to do with one another. But the Republicans have basically placed this abortion language into this human trafficking bill without the knowledge of the Democrats on the panel. Dianne Feinstein just today on NPR mentioned that her staff was unaware when they read the bill that certain numbers in that bill referred to this abortion language, and Democrats basically said they would not move forward on it. So Republicans are taking something that Democrats want, which is the nomination of confirmation of Loretta Lynch, and holding that back until they agree to the terms, which is passing this human trafficking bill, which they also, Democrats would also like to see passed, only if the abortion language is covered in it.
What is the problem with the abortion language? If you can just spell that out for our audience so that they can understand why the Senate Democrats are holding the line.
Yeah, I believe what it would do is codify the what is called the global gag rule, which prevents money from going toward overseas facilities that have anything to do with abortion or reproductive rights. I'm not certain on that, but I believe that is the case. Basically, this is something that gets ping-ponged through executive order every time that the White House changes hands from Republican to Democrat. Right now, under Democrats, the global gag rule has been set aside, but this would reinvigorate.
Now, Senators Harry Reid of Nevada and Michael Bennett of Colorado filibustered the trafficking bill in the Senate over this language. And I read that the GOP immediately used that as an excuse to send out robocalls to their constituents, as both senators are facing re-election. Does the GOP thrive best when they're stalling?
Well, this is absolutely what they do, is create these message bills that they can then take into ads and say, your senator has, voted against, stopping the scourge of human trafficking. I mean, this is exactly their MO, to create a situation that's sort of a Hobson's choice, where Democratic senators have to vote against something that is politically popular. So this is done, fairly regularly in Washington, and now with Republicans in charge, they have free rein to do this. This is in fact what Harry Reid has been trying to stop by preventing amendments and things like that when he was majority leader. He didn't want these message votes to have to be taken by his members of the Senate coalition. And so this is sort of manifesting itself in what the Republicans are doing. Hmm.
Now, Loretta Lynch, if she's confirmed, she would be the first African-American woman to be Attorney General, a second African-American to be Attorney General after Eric Holder. And Representative G.K. Butterfield, a Democrat from North Carolina, who's also the chairman of the Congressional Black Caucus, told reporters that his group is, quote, disturbed at the delay, and, quote, that's putting it mildly. He said, quote, one must wonder what are the reasons. I think race can certainly be considered a major factor in the reason for this delay, but it's also the irrationality of the new Republicans. Do you agree with what Representative Butterfield said?
I mean, I don't know if you could put race as the sole reason. It really looks like they're trying to squeeze as much as they can get out of this nomination. It's basically the modus operandi of the Republicans is to take something Democrats want and make sure they extract sort of maximum pain out of that.
David, they had no problem confirming Ashton Carter as defense secretary. He got a very speedy nomination.
Well, that's certainly true. And the real irony here is that Republicans for over 6 years have been condemning Eric Holder and almost every single move that he has made down the line, whether it's talking about Fast and the Furious or talking about his support for civil rights litigation, things like that. So here's the chance to dump Eric Holder, to get him out of the Justice Department, and they're holding off on.
And I should say Ashton Carter's confirmation, not just nomination, was nominated and confirmed pretty quickly. What has the president's response been to this stalling of Lynch's confirmation? Is he staying out of the way? Is he openly talking about it?
I think the response has been a little bit muted, but I mean, I think that the president in general has professed that he wants his nominees to move forward. I think Democrats in the Senate are really taking the lead on this and hammering it day after day after day. But certainly the president is more than desirous of getting Lynch confirmed and moving forward.
Now, there was more Republican news yesterday. Representative Aaron Schock abruptly resigned. It's not clear exactly why, but it's something to do with the misuse of tax dollars. Any idea what's going on? And I mean, it's interesting to see these, as you were saying, the message calls that Republicans make for Democrats looking for re-election, but their own party isn't quite on the up and up.
Yeah, I mean, Schock, there was just sort of a litany of allegations against Schock, and the most recent came out yesterday when he had billed the federal government 170,000 miles worth of reimbursements for travel in his district. And then when he returned the car only had 80,000 miles on it. So that is a clear discrepancy of at least 90,000 miles, it translates to $50,000. So that's sort of petty theft that's going on from a member of the party that's supposed to be the fiscally responsible one. There were other allegations about plane trips and free trips from donors and the use of taxpayer money to decorate his office in very grandiloquent manner, sort of in the manner of Downton Abbey.
Oh, my goodness.
There was a lot going on with Aaron Schock.
But God forbid that tax dollars are used for things like Social Security, Medicare, Obamacare, et cetera. The Republicans do manage to move fast when it comes to cutting the budget. And this week, the latest GOP-designed budget was released, and Paul Ryan's vision seems to once more have been infused into the entire thing. In a nutshell, the budget repeals Obamacare, overhauls Medicare, increases the military budget, and overall puts in cuts of $5.5 trillion. I'm guessing none of this is very surprising for you.
No, not at all. And actually, the most interesting thing about it is how the numbers actually don't add up. There's one part of the budget that includes $1.1 trillion in something very vaguely called other mandatory spending that is not really noted or explained in any real way. What they call this in budget terms is a magic asterisk. When your budget can't line up and you can't get to balance that you want to in 2024, but you don't want to be knowingly sort of whacking discretionary spending or vulnerable people, you put in, oh, and we're going to cut up $1.1 trillion more somehow. So it's a magic asterisk that gets you magically to budget balance, but it's not really based in reality.
Well, finally, David, how serious a battle looms ahead of us over this budget? Do you foresee a major, prolonged, and protracted government shutdown with this new Republican control of Congress that, as we've said before, is exactly the atmosphere within which the Republican Party seems to thrive, bringing everything to a halt?
I don't know about a government shutdown, but certainly there are a number of hurdles, must-pass bills that are going to have to be resolved one way or another, and Republicans seem like they do want to play hardball to get something out of those. And the two big ones are the budget, as you mentioned, and also the debt ceiling, which comes up. We're going to hit the debt ceiling probably right around the same time as the budget, maybe September, October. So those two deadlines fusing together creates a large leverage point for the Republican majority in Congress to try to extract some concessions out of the White House. And it's going to be interesting to see how far they can get.
David, I want to thank you, as always, for joining us today.
Thank you.
My guest, David Dayan, is a contributing writer to Salon and a weekly columnist of the Fiscal Times. This is Uprising. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Uprising. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. Many of us are involved in political activism, especially if you're tuned into this show. But what happens when you have kids? In my own life, I can remember being so involved about 10 years ago, you know, in anti-war activism, journalism, anti-racist actions, going to meetings and joining committees, marching and protests. And then I started to have children, and suddenly life felt like it split into the pre-childbirth and post-childbirth eras. The former is full of vigor and questioning and rebellion. The latter, more often than not, is consumed with diapers and school choices, choosing the right pediatrician, ensuring healthy diets, and schlepping kids to from soccer practice, worrying about being able to afford piano lessons, and on and on. Can one live a life true to one's political values and have children? My guest, Frida Bergen, writes about how her parents, who were high-profile activists, raised three children and how she attempts to navigate a similar path. Frida Bergen serves on the board of the War Resisters League and helped to found the group Witness Against Torture. She's also worked as a researcher with New America Media's Arms and Security Initiative and also as a columnist for Waging Nonviolence. And she's a mother who's just written the book It Runs in the Family on being raised by radicals and growing into rebellious motherhood. And today, as part of our ongoing series on the politics of parenting, we're proud to welcome Frida to the program. Hi, Frida.
Hi, how are you?
Doing well. Thanks for joining us. Well, first, tell us about your parents and your family. The name Bergen is synonymous with activism in the U.S.
Right. So Phil Bergen and Liz McAllister are my parents. They founded the Jonah House community in Baltimore, Maryland, and right before I was born. They were active in the anti-Vietnam War movement. My father was part of the Catonsville Nine, a group of nine people, of course, who burned draft files and then stayed to take responsibility for that action and carried the witness into the courtroom.
And Frida, we're going to call you on the phone while keeping your video active since the audio doesn't sound so good. So while we're doing that, let me just tell our listeners and our viewers that I'm speaking with Frida Bergen, who serves on the board of the War Resisters League, and she helped to found the group Witness Against Torture, and her book is called It Runs in the Family, on being raised by radicals and growing into rebellious motherhood. It's part of our ongoing series on the politics of parenting, which, by the way, if you want to listen to or watch our other interviews in that series, you can simply go to uprisingwithsonali.com. Frida, are you back with us?
Yes, I am.
Okay, great. So, yeah, so if you can just continue the story you were telling about your family.
Oh, sure. So the Catonsville Nine happened in 1968. My parents were both involved in high-profile anti-Vietnam War activity, went to jail for long periods of time as part of that. And then in the 1970s, after founding Jonah House, began to be anti-nuclear weapons activists, were part of founding the Plowshares movement. Hundreds of Plowshares actions have now taken place throughout the United States and also in Europe. And these are actions where a small group of people go onto nuclear weapons facilities and do a symbolic transformation of nuclear weapons. Mm-hmm. That movement just got sort of a high-profile treatment in the New Yorker magazine in an article by Eric Schlosser. So anyway, throughout all of these activities, you know, my parents had three children.
And I understand they didn't really want children, and they were planning on not having children, but they ended up with you and your siblings.
Yeah, you know how that happens sometimes. So they wanted to commit themselves fully to this work of revolution, of societal transformation, of bringing about peace and justice, didn't really see that children would fit into that. And then, of course, we did fit into that. They were helped very much by the fact that we lived in community. We lived with as many as 10 other people at different times. So responsibility for childcare was spread throughout the community in the same way that cooking meals and cleaning and contributing to the household economy was spread throughout the community.
Now, you write in your book that your parents found or counted that they spent a total of something like 11 years imprisoned for various radical political actions while you were children. How did that impact your family life? How does a family function when that happens?
Well, really, we continued to relate to one another mostly through letters. And so my childhood was written. You know, my parents wrote letters to us every day when they were away from us, when they were in prison. We wrote letters or dictated letters before we learned how to read and write. We worked very, very hard at it. Our parents worked very hard at it. As small children, we never really we saw our parents go off to jail very, very happy, very resolute, very strong. And it wasn't until we were much older that we realized that it was very difficult. It was very heart-wrenching for them to be separated from us. So they really accentuated the positive when we were small. They told us that it was our responsibility as that our work as kids was, was to be good, to do our chores, to follow the directions of the other adults that were taking care of us. And that this was our piece of the piecework. So we did that.
So being responsible children was your contribution to a better world.
That's right. That's right. And so we did that, and they did their part by which was was being in prison. They tried very hard not to be in prison at the same time, and were largely successful. I write in book about what was, in the grand scheme of things, a very short period of time of about 3 months, but was a really difficult period because my brother and I were both very young, responsibility for taking care of us fell to two members of our community. So after that experience, they tried and succeeded, as far as we can all remember, in not being in prison at the same time.
So now you found your life partner. You have children. I understand your husband is a peace activist, so at least you're both on the same page philosophically, which I'm guessing is a big advantage to living your life according to your values. But also you write that the way in which you're raising your children in this modern day is not the same as the way your parents raised you while being activists, right?
Right. Well, I think the big difference is that we don't live in an intentional community. You know, we have a household, and the five of us live here and don't share physical space with other people. And the other...
Whereas when you were growing up, it was a communal living situation?
Right. We lived, there were maybe as many as a dozen people living in our household. You know, the five of us are our family, and then, you know, six, seven, eight other people who are part of the community. Mm-hmm. Mostly single people, but sometimes other families with little children as well. Mm-hmm. So that's one big difference. We don't live in an intentional community. And the other is that, you know, my husband does have a job. He works for an organization that does domestic violence prevention and education. And then they run a shelter for victims and survivors of domestic violence. So in that way, you know, our life is sort of somewhat typical. You know, my husband goes off to work and I stay home, at least for now, with these little children. We have a three-year-old, he's almost three, Seamus, and a one-year-old Madeline, and then an eight-year-old Rosina.
And you're, of course, writing and working from home, but you and your husband are war tax resistors. And by the way, we can still see you on video, Frida, just so you know, we're keeping you on your video. You intentionally try to earn as little money as you can so that you don't have to pay taxes to fund wars. But while you're trying to raise children, how do you do that? I mean, children cost money. They need clothes, good, healthy food. They may want to play sports or learn music or take lessons. How do you... parent while earning not enough money to pay taxes because you're intentionally doing that as a political statement?
Right. Well, sorry, I just had to plug in my phone, plug in my computer here. Right. Well, we, you know, we rely on a lot of hand-me-downs. We do things that are free or very inexpensive. We are part of a community garden, and we grow a lot of our own food throughout the nicer weather. We, you know, we share a lot of stuff. We only have one vehicle. We try not to drive it that much. We do a lot of walking and taking advantage of city resources like a free playgroup and, you know, other free activities. There's a recreation department where the kids can sign up for swimming lessons and sports and all of that kind of stuff with, you know, that's very inexpensive and affordable. So so we're just trying to live really close to the ground, as close to the ground as we can.
Now,
Earthy Day talks about living with a sense of precarity, and so we live that way. You know, many people live in precarity, and we do as well, but in a sort of joyful precarity, if that's. I can say that.
Now, Frida, you have a chapter in your book on birthday parties, which I found very interesting. There's this culture of making birthday parties these days, huge affairs. You know, parents plan their kids' parties on Pinterest these days. I have to admit, I might have gone further down that path myself than I care to admit. But if you get invited to parties and you take your children to birthday parties that are super fancy and expensive, and your kid sees it and they want one too, and they want the goodie bags with all the plastic trash that you get into it that ends up in landfills, that really rifles your political feathers. How do you say no? How do you give them simple, low-waste, low-pressure parties that of the kinds that people used to throw? How can our children's birthday parties, for example, fit our moral compass today?
Right. I mean, I think it comes down to saying no and explaining why. You know, and so far, you know, it has worked pretty well. Our 8-year old, her birthday is right after Christmas. And so, she's actually, her birthday is, New Year's Eve. And so when, we have birthday parties, we invite her whole class and all of our friends. So, you know, there's 25 kids running around. We do it at our church. We belong to a Unitarian Universalist congregation. So, you know, we have this big that is very affordable.
Frida, we seem to have lost your audio.
Oh.
Oh, there you go. I think you're back.
Oh.
Continue.
Okay. You know, we ask that people not bring presents because it's just been Christmas and, you know, everybody's just spent way too much money, and Rosina has gotten a ton of Christmas presents. So we draw a very hard line and say no presents. And then that gets us off the hook for any goodie bags or swag bags that we have to give out to other people.
How do you keep your children from resenting you for these things? I mean, my father grew up in a household that was headed by a member of the Communist Party. My grandfather, strong communist, very Spartan household, refused to let his son have any luxuries, wouldn't let my father get braces because he thought that was vanity. And my father rebelled and grew up and all, you know, just wanted to be a capitalist. And we, you know, I have that fear about my children, that if I say no to the luxuries that are part of our consumer culture, that they grow up to resent you.
Well, I mean, check back with me, Sonali, in 10 years. But
you didn't resent your parents.
I didn't. I definitely wanted things. I definitely coveted the things I saw my classmates have. But I guess I had a framework to put things in. I had a framework for our simple living. And I knew that when my parents said, no, you can't have that nice thing, they weren't just saying no out of a political position. They were saying no because we did not have the money to afford it, and because it wasn't like they were wearing really nice clothes and you know, kind of fulfilling all of their desires and just saying no to me. We were all living this very Spartan kind of existence, and so and the no was practical too. We just didn't have it. And so in a similar fashion, I mean, we are not, you know, neglecting our children. We're not denying them the basics. They do have a lot of fun. They enjoy life a lot. They just don't have a lot of just superfluous stuff. Mm-hmm. And we say no. Just the way we say no, my husband and I say no to our own desires to go out to dinner all the time or go see a lot of movies or, you know, just kind of
do you think, Frida,
do whatever we want, whenever we want to do it.
Do you think that you're living your life in this way is actually a privilege? I mean, many Americans actually try to earn more, you know, enough to be able to pay taxes and can't. You know, they don't have the choice. They may not be. They may be hauled off to prison without a choice. They may be forced to have their kids wear used clothing and have too little, again, not by choice. You and your husband have the ability to choose to live a certain way that not everybody has. Is that right?
Sure. It is a choice. It's a whole series of choices. And I'm certainly not saying everybody should live the way we're living. There is risk involved in not paying taxes. There's sacrifices and choices that we're making to just be living with one income. But it does, you know, I mean, many families pay 2/3 of their income or one of their incomes in child care. A recent article, depending on where you live, you can pay 47% of one of your incomes in childcare. And so that is an expense that we do not have.
Right.
And there are other expenses that kind of are ancillary to that. You know, when you have two parents working, you often need two cars. You come home from work and you don't want to cook dinner. You don't want to shop for groceries. You end up spending a lot more on food because you order in or you buy food that's already prepared instead of buying, from the outside of the grocery store, the outer ring of the grocery store instead of the inside of it. And so
Frieda, we've been talking about how our politics might get in the way of parenting. Let's talk about how parenting might get in the way of politics for those people who are political activists who don't have children by choice. It can be a political act to be childless. It can be simply a choice, you know, that someone might not want children, more power to them. But and your parents were intending to not have children, accidentally had them. What advice can you give to people worried that having kids might get in the way of political activism? Have you managed to maintain your values and your activism while being as good a parent as you can be?
Right. Well, I think that's the big question, and I think that it comes down to what is politics and how do we live our politics, and do we live our politics in going to demonstrations and going to meetings? Or do we live our politics in the small choices that we're making every day and the small choices that we're making? And I think you can do both. And I think in some ways it comes down to, and this might sound sort of hokey, but in blooming where you're planted. I think these early years of being a parent have been a real education for me in having to scale back my expectations of myself. I can't be everywhere I want to be. I can't be on the front line, so to speak.
And of course, women tend to bear the biggest brunt of this compared to fathers.
Oh, sure. Yeah. You see lots of dads at meetings, and you don't see lots of moms at meetings. It is easier for fathers to kind of step outside of the home in many ways. And, I write in the book about this phenomenon of dads babysitting their children instead of parenting them. And, every time my husband goes to the grocery store with our kids, he gets a standing ovation from mostly from women, like, "Oh, you go, Dad! Like, good for you." And I never get a standing ovation going to the grocery.
Well, I'm giving you a standing ovation right now, Frieda. I want to thank you so much for joining us today, and best of luck with your book.
Oh, thank you. It was great to talk to you, Sonali.
My guest, Frieda Berrigan, serves on the board of the War Resisters League and helped to found the group Witness Against Torture. Her book is called It Runs in the Family, on being raised by radicals and growing into rebellious motherhood, part of our coverage on the politics of parenting. This is Uprising. Bipa Shoshone is our senior producer. Anna Buss is our assistant producer. Christian Beck is our production coordinator. Corinne Gaston is our research intern. Joseph Stone is our technical director. Federico Garcia is our audio engineer. Annie Mendoza is our social media coordinator. Subscribe to our YouTube channel at youtube.com/uprisingwithsonali. Our website is uprisingwithsonali.com. Our theme music is by Quetzal. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, host and executive producer of Uprising. I'll see you tomorrow.